Welcome to the Consulting Growth Podcast. I'm Professor Joe Omani, a professor of consulting at Cardiff University and an advisor to consultancies that want to grow. If you'd like to find more out about me and access some free resources to help your consultancy grow, do please visit joeomani.com. That's joeomahoney.com. Okay, thank you for joining us. Today we have the pleasure of Will Evans with us, who is a director at Arrowpoint Advisory, which is a part of Rothschild & Co. Will, thank you for joining us. It's really great to have you on here. I was wondering if, as a kickoff, you could give us a little bit of background about the transitions in your career so far and how you ended up at Arrowpoint, please.
Yep, very happy to, Joe. Thank you for having me. So I started as an accountant within the Big Four. So I was at Deloitte for a number of years as an auditor for my sins. 2015 is when I moved out, and I moved to what was at the time one of the large independent mid-market M&A advisory firms, which was Livingston Partners. 3 years ago, Livingston became part of Rothschild & Co, and we're now called Arrowpoint. So we're now the dedicated mid-market M&A advisory firm within Rothschild & Co. So a lot of what we do is focus on entrepreneurial businesses. I sit within our business services team, have done since I've been here. And now my core focus is on the consultancy market. So I lead our team in the consultancy market.
Brilliant. Thank you. And when you say for listeners, who are new to this space, and they may have an idea that merger and acquisition is something that they might be looking at somewhere down the line, what does that actually mean in practice for what you guys do?
So a large part of what we do is working with founder entrepreneurs as we look at their strategic options, whether that be 1, 2, or 3 years out. Often there will be a liquidity event or a transaction in mind. And that transaction may be an outright sale to a strategic buyer. It could be a private equity led transaction, which can take a number of forms. So you might have a majority investment from private equity that allows a more passive founder to cash out and sort of go on their next venture. You might look at a more of a partnership structure from private equity, which allows the shareholders to de-risk and go again in a sort of with a more ambitious mindset with a new partner. Sometimes we also can just purely raise, do a capital raise or just a debt raise with no cash out for the founders. That's less common amongst the consultancy market, but it's something we often consider. Our role is ultimately to help them work through the options, design and run a process that delivers on the stakeholders' sort of aspirations. And I guess incumbent on that, and this is where we therefore spend a lot of our time, is we spend a lot of time talking to strategic buyers. We know all the large corporates very well. We need to understand what they're looking at and which of our clients might be of interest to who. We spend a lot of time discussing opportunities with private equity, both showing them things and also a lot of time on the buy side. So that gives us a perspective of from the other side of the table in terms of what they're looking at, what they like, what they don't like, which is very valuable. So I guess given that perspective, one thing we always look to do is work informally with clients for a good few years, ideally, ahead of a transaction. And it's particularly acute in the consultancy sector. There's a lot that founders can be thinking about that is within their control to maximize the chance of the right outcome. So that's how we like to engage. It doesn't always work like that.
Yeah, great. Okay, so this is gold dust for many of the listeners to this podcast. We often speak to people who have ended up selling their firm, but actually getting some insights into the different options that are available when it comes to liquidity or exit, etc., is really important. Now, I'd like to start getting into a little bit of the details about the options out there, the most common options. And obviously, we have potentially strategic buyers who will be buying a firm for, well, strategic purposes, typically to fill a gap or to cross-sell. We also have private equity. We have management buyouts. We have, as you say, different forms of debt leverage that can occur. I'm guessing the two most common for you would be the strategic buyers and private equity. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's right. But I guess within those, there are lots of different forms and lots of different structures. And there's definitely not a set route for either of them. There's a gray area. There's a lot of private equity backed strategics now that offer a hybrid solution. In the context of simplifying things, looking at trade versus private equity is the easiest way to look at things.
To put it in relatively simple terms, what are the big differences between private equity and strategic buyers in terms of what they're looking for and how the deals typically work? I realise there will be exceptions to the rule. Will, I was wondering if you could put it in relatively simple terms in terms of the differences between private equity and strategic or trade purchases, both in terms of what they're typically looking for and also how those deals typically work?
Yep, very happy to. So I think let's look at the former. So as you've alluded to, their strategic buyers will often be looking for something they don't already have. Showing them opportunities which very much mirror a capability they've already got internally doesn't tend to get them overly excited. So often new capabilities is the main driver there. We're increasingly seeing across markets where supply shortages and talent is quite acute, where those issues are quite a big constraint on growth for some of the large corps, we're often seeing them as a way of getting hold of talent fast and efficiently. And we're seeing that across the technology landscape more than anything. So large bases of very technical talent that is employed makes you a very attractive strategic acquisition at the moment. We often see them as a strategic acquirer looking for a platform in an industry. So you may look, if you have specialist focus on, say, financial services or pharma, those tend to be quite hot markets that might fill a gap. And increasingly, we're looking at especially sort of European and US private equity backed strategics who are looking to internationalize, looking for UK platforms. So once you get to a sufficient scale where you can be considered a platform, you become quite interesting to some of the international acquirers. That's what trade's looking at. Private equity model lends itself very well to people businesses. We can come on to why, but essentially private equity are looking to make a return for their investors, and they tend to invest over a 3 to 6 year investment period. If things go very well, they'll exit within 3 years, maybe shorter in exceptional cases. What they're looking to do really is align the incentives of the people driving the value with the equity upside. So their structures tend to put a lot of equity into the hands of those driving the value. And they're looking at end markets that are ideally both high growth and resilient. There's a historical skepticism around project-based businesses for private equity, and starting the year with only a few months of revenue booked can make them a bit nervous. So they tend to therefore be very hung up on KPIs around visibility, reoccurring relationships with clients, the length of those relationships, and how the sort of the outlook looks over the next 12, 24 months. So often they're very data focused in how they look at assets in this space. But really, essentially, what they're looking for is a committed team, and having a team that is there for that investment period and ideally beyond is very important. Structural growth in the market and a clear differentiation both from a client value proposition. So why are your clients buying you over other options in the market, and also an employee or talent proposition? Because especially in the current market, the way that it is around talent, being able to attract the right people is fundamental to any growth thesis. So that's what they're looking at. And there's a lot of overlap within that. Good assets attract interest from both parties for obvious reasons. I think the difference is in the structures. And often this one's slightly harder to define, but I think you can bucket it in a few ways. So the first one would be around sort of time horizons for the founders. If we assume that a founder remains quite important to the business and nobody wants them going off and sitting on the beach on day one, private equity will often look for you to reinvest a large proportion of the value that you create during the transaction. A founder might look to reinvest or might need to reinvest around 50% of the value they crystallize. And what that normally means is a founder will need to be committing for the investment cycle. So you might need to get comfortable that you're going to be in there for the next 4 to 6 years, unless you've pre-agreed a transition away from the business over a shorter period and you've got a very good successor in place to take over. But that would be operationally. The fact that you've reinvested so much of your capital means that emotionally, you're still going to be very invested in the success of the business. And you probably won't feel like you won't feel comfortable going away and being completely hands off for the whole of that period. A trade sale, on the other hand, tends to present a fast exit for the founders. So it would be very unusual to not have an earnout in a trade deal for a consultancy. The length of that earnout is often something we negotiate a lot. We try and get it as short as possible. They tend to start at 3 to 4 years. If we can get it down to 1 to 2 years, we've done well. So if we assume that you end up with a 2-year earnout, you can probably work that 2-year earnout. You probably have 12 months of restriction and restrictions in your contract, and then you'll be able to do whatever you want in, say, 3 years. That's the way they're structured. I guess that in terms of what that means for, I guess, value in terms of private equity, if you have strong conviction over the future of the business, a private equity deal means that the liquidity event today is not going to be as material as the one in the future. So really, this is about more about finding the right partner de-risking your position. And really, if you think the business is going to double or triple in size in the next 4 years, it's that transaction where you're going to make your big payday. A trade deal often doesn't let you share in that upside so much. So there might be some upside in the earnout, but really what you're doing on day one by selling 100% of the shares is you're capping the value that you could take out of the business. But I guess you're also allowing yourself to get out of the business. They're probably the main two differences. I think when, from a founder's perspective, the biggest consideration is often around the desire to remain independent. So we often have clients who come to us and we think about options, but they immediately say, look, the fact that we're independent, we have a very unique culture. Lots of our people left Accenture to come and work here because we're something different. We care about our people. We care about our clients. Of course, we don't want to be absorbed by a larger corporate and go back into that environment. So if that's the mindset from the beginning, private equity becomes the optimal option. And I guess the other thing that is probably the biggest driver of who ends up doing the transaction, if you did, for example, show it to both parties, is really what the business needs. Businesses who have become quite sophisticated, they've got a very compelling proposition. They can grow from 50 to 100 to 200 people independently because they've got the systems in place to do that. They've got the value, the client value. They've got the recruitment machine in place to do that. They can do that remaining independent with financial support. Some consultancies will reach a critical point in their evolution where you reach 50 heads. You might struggle to grow organically by yourself. You don't have the infrastructure. You don't quite have the clout or the brand in the market. And those founders and those people might feel that they're better served by becoming part of a large strategic to really take the business to the next level. So that's also a big consideration.
Thank you. I mean, so much great information in such a period of time there. Now, I'd like to go back to the private equity, because certainly when I started advising consultancies on growth, private equity was hardly mentioned at all. And this is going back 15, 17 years now. What has changed? And also, it used to have a relatively bad reputation in terms of, it was always associated with asset strippers or unfair deals and all the rest of it. Now, I think you know that has changed, both in terms of the presence of private equity, but also what they tend to do with firms. If I'm an ambitious owner that sees great growth potential for the firm and doesn't want it absorbed into the Borg, why should I seriously consider private equity these days?
Good question. You're absolutely right. There is a reticence amongst some of our clients because they have that view that private equity are going to come in and slam their fist on the table and run their business for them. There's a very widespread acceptance now that the way successful private equity investments into professional services or people businesses, the only way of doing it is to partner effectively with the team, incentivize the team properly, work closely with them, add value, because the crux of the matter is that team is the value of your investment. And if you start losing that team or they become demotivated, your investment loses value very rapidly. So there's sort of two reasons why private equity are very interested in this space now. The first one actually, I think, is less about the structure, but more of a macro point around this market. I think if you look at, I guess, consultancies more broadly, the macro trends for growth are there and they're robust and they're long term. The world is changing faster than ever. Technology is evolving more rapidly than ever. The proliferation of data is growing at us beyond what we know what to do with it effectively. The political landscape's as complex as ever. The climate crisis is going to last the next 50 years and beyond. So the structural demand there in certain pockets of the market means that private equity can't ignore it as a growth market. And especially when you look at how certain markets are defined by skill shortages, it's fairly clear that the demand is there and that there are now solutions that can address the skill shortages to close that gap. And there's a big opportunity there. So the macro thesis is there, and digital transformation is a word that gets banded around a lot, but there's not many investors in the mid-market that don't have some interest in sort of going along for the ride in terms of that trend. So that's why they like the market. And the structures that they're now putting in place around how they partner lend themselves very, very well to people businesses. There's two sides to that. One is, I think we see a lot of founders running their consultancies in a relatively conservative way. So you might focus on making sure there's profit every year so you get your dividend out. And quite rightly, you should be running it conservatively because often that will be your single biggest personal source of wealth. And you don't want to do anything reckless or invest ahead of the curve with what's a very important asset to you. So there's a founder-owned mindset that can change a lot when you bring private equity on board. And much of that is around de-risking. If a founder is able to liquidate 50% of their holding in their company, they can pay off their mortgage. They can, in many cases, secure their family's financial future. And then you can go back into the business with a supportive partner who's done this before and say, how do we actually grow this 3, 4, 5 times faster than we have been in the past? And a lot of that will involve making sort of quite big investments in people, in systems, infrastructure, maybe developing product and trying to sort of change the value proposition. So there's a lot that can be done. And a term we hear a lot is investing ahead of the curve. And especially where demand is so strong at the moment, if you can have the conviction to hire very rapidly and bring the talent on board, even though it might not be fully utilized on day one, it makes for a more strategic value in 4 or 5 years' time. So that the mindset on how you run the business and sort of getting in bed with an investor for a 3 to 5 year value creation journey has worked incredibly well. The other side of the structure that they focus on is the ability to develop a capital structure that allows you to incentivize both the senior team with a lot of equity and also cascade that quite a long way down the organization. So you end up with quite widespread equity ownership within the business. And what that does to the culture of growth and business development and the way that everyone is there focused on value creation and the next event in 3, 4, or 5 years' time. It's not just the senior team that are driving that. It's everyone that is important throughout the organization. It also allows you to, and I guess that's also important from a retention perspective. So when important people have equity, they're less likely to leave if there's value in that equity, because the provisions would say that you lose a lot of that value if you were to leave. It also allows you to attract new heavy hitting people, because you can attract them not just with market comp, but also with equity, with a short to medium term liquidity event in sight. So the structure is working well. And on top of that, we've seen a lot of success stories in the last 5, 10 years, which is only making this sector and this structure attracts more and more interest.
Yes, from my perspective, it's fascinating strategically, because don't get me wrong, consultancies have always, not all of them, but they've always been interested in growth. But there seems to be a much clearer path to growth, investment, exit as almost a de facto standard for any consultancy with more than 5 people now. Whereas certainly when I started advising, going back 20 years, you were still at the end of the phase where it was much more of a lifestyle business, most people I encountered. And I don't know whether I think it's, as you say, a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways, because you see some of the great sales, you see all these people being made millionaires by their exit. And also there's more education, people are doing more MBAs, so they're seeing more cases of this type of stuff. And of course, the market is so much bigger than it was 20 years ago. It's, consulting is huge now compared to what it was.
Yeah. And look, it's an interesting point around the lifestyle point, because there are still small consultancies that are run as lifestyle businesses. And we speak to a lot of them who are sort of, they're very comfortable with taking out their dividends every year, running it as a partnership. And their vision is to continue doing that for the next decade. There is obviously a large pool of those players out there, but there is a critical mass. And this is not just in scale, but it's in terms of institutionalization and becoming not lifestyle, but becoming a business. And that's quite an important transition that you need to go through before you start looking for external investment or a sale. That's possibly one of the biggest risks to a successful transaction, is exposing yourself to the market when you are still a little bit lifestyle led, looking a bit more like a partnership than a business. And that tends to be when you tend to need to be north of 50 people, ideally 100 people, and have a lot more institutionalization in place around business development. You probably need a slightly more diverse client base. You don't want to just stick to the 4 or 5 clients that you set the business up on the back of, because you had them as former clients wherever you were before. You need to show that you can win new logos. You need to show that you can hire people at a serious tempo and that you're not just hiring from your network or leveraging associates too much. So there is definitely a step change if you can get through what's quite a challenging period and a challenging change in mindset for a lot of entrepreneurs. It's not easy, but you really want to have worked through that and embedded it before you start exposing yourself to the market.
I guess this is my niche, I guess, in that I typically get people coming to me 20, 30, 40, 50. And sometimes they'll say, is it possible to sell? Because, we're getting on, or, we've had a good ride, or growth's been fantastic and we want to cash in. And my advice is generally, you can sell, but in terms of the multiples that you'll be getting and the caveats that are put on the contract, they're going to be quite punishing because, in effect, they're buying people. They're not buying an asset that's a business that has systems and processes and roles and all the rest of it. And as it's highly dependent on you, you're not going to be getting the reward that you think you might be getting. And that's in the best of cases. You know, as you well know, people sometimes approach and say, you know, we're ready to sell now. And it's another 3 years. But let's talk a little bit about that, because that's something I see quite commonly is a guy or woman will be in their early 60s and be thinking about cashing out and will approach me or one of the people we know and say, we'd like to exit. And don't get me wrong, revenue's great. Margins are decent. Sometimes growth is decent. But then you look at the business and you think, oh, actually, people aren't going to be interested, or there aren't going to be many buyers interested in this firm. So if you agree with that proposition, I guess, could you talk a little bit around what founders should have in place before they start thinking about a sale seriously?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I completely agree with everything you've just said. And I think from a strategic sale perspective, it can sometimes be even more binary. A lot of the larger strategics don't buy things that are too small because it's not worth their time and effort. And there's just as much work goes into a £10 million transaction as a £200 million transaction. So why would they spend their time on the smaller ones that don't move the needle? But it's not all about scale. I wouldn't necessarily want to tell people that you need to get to a certain scale to consider exposing yourself to the market. When I think about institutionalization and sort of moving towards more of a business or a machine than a collection of people, the main thing tends to be the reliance on the founder. And as you say, you'll have founders come along and there might be a couple of them and they might be looking to do a transaction. But really, if they hold all of the key client relationships, if they're still involved in recruitment, if they still know absolutely everything that's going on in the business because it's that small and they know everyone personally, no buyer or investor in their right mind is going to want to put too much cash into their hands for their business without some serious provisions around locking them in. It doesn't mean a transaction can't be crystallized, but the transaction structure will be such that they don't get much cash on day one. They're expected to remain in the business for another 3 to 5 years and continue to drive growth. And the overall value placed on the business will be a lot smaller. There's the founder piece. The key point, more from a private equity perspective, but also a bit from strategics, is around clients, and concentration on one or two large clients is inherently just going to be considered a risk for private equity. You might go and tell them that client's been with you for 10 years and they've told you they're going to be with you for another 10 years. But if private equity go and tell their investment committee that, how are they going to believe them? Because it's just your word versus no one else's. So concentration is a big risk. And normally that comes with being a bit smaller. And that's not to say larger consultancies don't have some concentration, but there tends to be some correlation there. So being able to show that you've been able to win new logos and that there are new growth accounts that are going to dilute that is also important. So the I guess the other point is around recruitment. So we see a lot of smaller consultancies who've hired 30, 40, 50 people, largely from their own networks, and then they leverage associates to deal with peaks in demand. Given so much of growth is obviously incumbent on increasing headcount and hiring, if you don't have a clear employee proposition or an ability or a recruitment engine that allows you to go to the graduate pool or allows you to go to the big four or the larger consultancies and attract them away, then your growth story is difficult to support. So having that recruitment infrastructure that underpins your talent pipeline is very important. And within that, the journey to hire, retain, train, and developing your people is important too. I guess the other one, when you're a bit small, well, often we get clients come to us that they've been thinking about doing a transaction for a couple of years. They think the profit number that they report is going to be the most important number to the value of their business. So what they've not done is invested in the systems and the infrastructure in place to firstly drive growth in the business or have a sophisticated CRM system that means that they're got a very institutionalized BD and they've got access to all the data that you need to demonstrate the growth story. They probably don't have a very sophisticated finance function in place. They're probably going to struggle to pull together the clean data that we like to present the market to underpin the story. And when you haven't invested in your overhead sufficiently, everyone can see that very obviously, and it ends up going to value anyway. And it's not considered a sustainable way to grow your business. So we would much rather people make investments ahead of the curve. And then we look at that number and we try and say, look, this was a one-off investment. So we actually can add that back.
Yeah. That's great. I was just thinking, a lot of my clients, when I talk about this systematization or institutionalization, as you call it, worry that they're going to lose the essence, the creativity, the tailored approach that they love doing.
Yeah.
But I always say it's like an architecture. If you've got a solid base, it allows you to build the more creative stuff. It allows you to have lovely decorations and do a more tailored approach and be quite creative. But it's about building that solid base. And so I always see systems, processes, roles, etc., as enabling you to do the work that you enjoy more and to do more of it, rather than it actually having to standardize the work.
Completely. I mean, when you get founders who love delivering to clients but are telling you that they're not able to sell more work because they're too busy running the finance function or recruiting and doing interviews to hire people, you know something's not right. And often that they will look to leverage a larger strategic partner to do that. And that's where a trade sale is actually the right thing for the business.
I think an important model here, just reinforcing what you said earlier about the importance of investing in the institutionalization of the business, is that if you think about EBITDA and then you think about the multiple of EBITDA, you can break your back really trying to increase a few percentage points in EBITDA. Whereas actually, if you invested in the things that allow the multiple to go up from, say, 5 to 7 or from 7 to 9, then you're making a much bigger mark on the actual sale price that you'll be getting. And so I see that multiple as being much more dependent on the systems, processes, pipeline, and all the rest of that being institutionalized properly.
Exactly, the multiple, but also it's a bit more binary. It'll be very difficult to get a transaction crystallized without those things in place. So it's a bit more fundamental than even that.
And also, it's relatively cheap to do this now. So I'm not talking about buying in fractional finance people, but I mean, in terms of systems, now we have professional service automation, we have CRM systems. You can outsource a lot of the marketing function to cheaper resource. It's much cheaper than it was even 10 years ago to do some of this stuff.
No, exactly. And it should be being done. It should be done well in advance of the process as well. So it's embedded. The last thing you want is someone to be scrambling to do this 6 months before they go to market, so to speak.
I'd like to talk to you briefly about something that I'm sure you will have seen and I see a reasonable amount, which is someone coming to you and saying, listen, we've got this, we've got a great firm and we know it's a great firm because this company has offered to buy us and it looks fantastic. And can you help us go ahead with this deal? What is your advice in that situation?
Generally, to take approaches with a fairly large pinch of salt. Approaches happen all the time now as in-house M&A teams become more sophisticated, and they do fire out approaches quite far and wide just to try and get someone on the hook. They would love to, in many cases, they would love to be able to buy an asset off market that hasn't been advised by someone like us and hasn't been shown to any other parties. And that's why they do it quite proactively. If they're a private equity backed strategic, we see that more and more as well. They go very wide with their approaches. So, and then if it's private equity, very similarly, they have big deal origination teams. They love to have these initial conversations, try to sell themselves and get stuff done. So if someone's come to me in that situation, then I guess good, well done, because engaging completely off market doesn't tend to solicit the best outcome. When on the buy side, you manage to achieve something off market for a client, you tend to think you've got a fairly good result. So I guess you'd want to think long and hard about if that is the right partner for you. If it's a knockout that's a partner that you do 50% of your work with in partnership, and in reality, no one else would buy you because of that incumbency with that partner, then that's probably the only home for the business. And there's no point looking elsewhere. If they're putting forward terms that you're very excited by and that you think it's the right thing for the business, then maybe. If there's any umming and ahhing, it's very easy to explore other options very quickly. It's very easy for someone like us to make 4 or 5 anonymous calls with alternative options and try and get a sense of whether they would be just as interested and whether you're leaving something on the table here by just being a bit blinded by an approach. So I'd take it with a pinch of salt and keep your options open would be my best advice.
Talk me through the process. So I got a decent sized consultancy. It's got decent growth, decent margins, decent revenue. I've started to attract new logo and I've got a decent pipeline of work. And I come to you with a view of ideally exiting in a year, maybe 18 months. And you're quite happy with the company.
Yep.
What does the process look like from an M&A perspective?
So first and foremost, we would want to do fairly rigorous health check on whether we think the business can stand up to the market and the rigors that come with a process. So we would put our buy side hats on and we would ask you for all the information that a buyer or investor will look at. We'll pull together very similar analysis to what they'll look at to make sure there's no glaring issues. And we'll challenge you on anything that we see, any trends that might be going in the wrong direction, any perceived negatives about the business. We tend to do that quite robustly. And that can take a few months. And I guess alongside doing that exercise, we'll always want to consider your strategic options.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a fair amount of modeling around private equity situations that might work for you and deal structures. We will look at who the likely strategic buyers are, if that's the route you want to go down. We'll make sure we understand all the stakeholders' aspirations, which will be the founders. It can be external finance providers or silent partners. It can be the management team. We'll make sure we know what everybody wants to achieve. Once we're happy that we know what everyone wants to achieve and the business has checked out and we think there's going to be sufficient interest, we will start preparing for exposing the business to market or preparing for that process. So this is where it can be very different. There's no straight line. There's no vanilla process that we've run. It would all be very curated based on how wide we want to go. We might just want to speak to a handful of parties. You might want to go very diverse to make sure no stone is left unturned. And we would carefully prepare the business to be exposed to the market. So we would pull together all of the marketing materials. Increasingly common would be to do for the vendors to initiate due diligence. So we would have our own due diligence reports done and we would make sure there's consistency within all of the materials that we would be showing the market. And then from there on, it's very difficult to say how it really works.
Yep.
The most important thing in our role and for the shareholders throughout this whole period is to continue protecting the business because lots of our clients will underestimate the time burden on them and the intensity of going through a process.
Yes.
And so obviously you want hands-on advisors that can be as useful as possible. That goes without saying. But it's also worth clients considering bringing on interim resource to help them and making sure that the business is prioritized. The worst thing you can have if you want the most successful outcome, the worst thing that you can have is the business to undertrade during the process. You want to constantly be dripping positive news about the business into the market as you engage with people. So that's why it's very important we're prepared. We therefore try and take the burden off the team as much as possible. There will always be a time when buyers and investors will want to be meeting with the team and that can take a lot of
their time. I want to test a hypothesis with you. So I agree with everything you've said. It's I think taking your eye off the ball is not something that founders should be doing, and it's a highly involved, complicated process. And both you and I will have seen firms that did take their eye off the ball. Sales dropped, buyers pulled out, and sometimes whole deals collapsed. I occasionally find, and I don't want to generalize about this, but I occasionally find that the founders who have grown the company from scratch are very often, quite rightly, they're very keen on watching the bottom line. They part with their shares reluctantly, not all of them. And then when it comes to paying out for advisors for M&A, especially, they look at some of the fees and they think, I've grown this company from scratch. I'm quite capable. I'm sure I can probably do this myself. Now, you probably don't see so many of these people because maybe they don't come to you. But is this something that you see at all in the founder mindset or some founders' mindset?
Yes, what we do. And recognizing the value of an advisor is not something that's immediately obvious to some founders.
It's ironic, really, isn't it? Because that's very often what they do. It's they sell their expertise as value add. But don't.
And look, there tends to be a scale of transaction where advisors become a lot more cost effective and it would be far more normal. Yeah. But I guess if you've built a successful consultancy and you want to run a blue chip process that attracts all the right buyers, you need to have blue chip advisors on your side. And it would be the market would find it odd if a business that was claiming to be worth 100 million and it was the next great thing with a capability that no one else has, they would find it very odd if you didn't go to market with a proper advisor. So it's seen as the norm. It tends to make, as you say, it tends to protect the business through the process, which in itself can be worth a huge amount more than the advisor's fees end up being. But it also, there's a lot of complexity, and having someone on your side that knows the ins and outs of the back end of a deal where things can get very nuanced and complex, knowing someone who understands what market norm is and understands what you should be getting away with, that in itself, when you're dealing with quite large numbers, can pay back our fee and some.
I wanted to pick up on two things finally. The first is something that we haven't mentioned at all, and that's around management buyouts. But the second is something that you mentioned previously, and I've certainly seen a lot of, which is the importance of an employee value proposition in today's market. And it's something that I've seen people pay lip service to quite frequently, but certainly over the last 2 years, I've never seen so much focus on people. I don't know if that's true. Yeah, okay. And so why is that? And is it going to get any better? Well, how's your crystal ball looking?
Yeah, I mean, how does it get better? Is it not a good thing that employee value propositions are very high up the list?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, okay, so I'll give you an insight. So I chaired a dinner of CEO founders, typically 100 to 200 employees, not so long ago, a couple of months ago. And when we got onto the subject of employees, they were all pulling their hair out because they had never seen, firstly, employee turnover going up, secondly, people asking for pay rises, and thirdly, just so much competition in the market for talent. So from a founder's perspective, especially if they had always, it had more been lip service than reality about the value proposition, they were finding it quite hard going. Perhaps the answer there is that you need to work on your value proposition for your employees.
Possibly. I mean, it's a, from our perspective, it's something that's very hard to really grasp as an employee value proposition, because we're not in there working for the company. And a lot of our founder clients will say why they are such a special place to work.
Yes.
They'll have all the badges that demonstrate it. And then we always ask them if we can see the raw data behind your hiring and churn numbers. And inevitably, they're never quite as good as the narrative that goes around it. It's a challenge. I mean, how does that play into the M&A market? I mean, if you think about what it does do, is places a lot more value on employed technical talent pools. So especially in the technology consulting space, if you have a large pool of data scientists or software engineers that are employed, that becomes a very valuable asset that you've got. And especially in the eyes of strategic buyers, they're having similar challenges to hiring and retaining people. So that's sort of one trend that we're seeing in terms of why strategics are paying a lot of money if you can successfully build up a talent pool. I mean, it's a good thing in terms of, I mean, if you look at skill shortages more broadly, as I mentioned earlier, it's a good thing because it shows that the demand is there and that there's a lot of demand to go around. And skill shortages are something we can address. What we've also seen is a lot of value being placed on academy models or players who are able to tap into the graduate market and have quite a strong presence at graduate events. Yep. And they're able to sort of quite clearly show how they're able to attract the top graduates and develop them and train them in whatever they need to be trained in. So it places a bit more emphasis on where is your talent pool and how are you going to attract them and how are you going to train them? Yep. Because to be honest, people, more and more, you'd go down to the grad. If you can't find seasoned professionals that you want, you do have to lean more on the graduate pool in combination with a training or academy model.
Sure.
The inflation point, I mean, is not going anywhere in the medium term. I think it's actually quite a good test for consultancies, in my mind, in terms of how strong your client value proposition is that if you can pay your consultants 10% more, if you can pass that on to your clients at the same rate, it demonstrates very clearly that your clients value what you're doing.
Yep.
And the best consultancies in the market are successfully doing that. And interestingly, that it's a market, although there are lots of downsides to a project-based business, more so than with other professional sectors of the professional services world where you might have longer-term managed service contracts. The ability to renegotiate your fees at the end of each 2, 3, 4 month project actually makes you a bit more resilient in that inflationary environment. Challenges, yes, and I don't envy CEOs and founders who are in that position, but it does play into some of the trends that we're seeing.
And you're completely right. I mean, with my executive MBAs, here's a fictional company, how do you increase profit per partner? They say, well, you increase leverage, you decrease wages, and you put up prices. And then I say, well, how do you increase profit per partner without screwing the business? And then we have a more in-depth conversation. Of course, one of the key mechanisms is providing higher value services by training people better. I think it's something that many startup consultancies come to quite late, is a realization that the systems and processes also need to apply to adding value to the people that they've got. I'm a great believer in training your people up rather than buying in sort of big stars from elsewhere. One thing we haven't mentioned is management buyouts. Is it something that you have experience of? And if so, what's your advice when it comes to MBO?
So the private equity transaction that I sort of alluded to first would be plus the management buyout, which is where you have a founder who is no longer involved in the business, but still owning the vast majority of the equity. The management buyout in that sense would involve bringing, in most cases, it would involve private equity. It's challenging to do it just with debt. Some people try. And some people use employee ownership trusts, which is a conversation for another day and not very fit for purpose solution. So if you bring private equity in to cash out the founder and the private equity house gets very comfortable that that founder is no longer needed in the business, they can essentially liquidate 100% of their value. So the challenge there is you end up with a private equity investor who owns a majority of the business. They have a majority control mindset, which can be slightly different to the more minority partnership mindset that we discussed earlier that was working very well. But part of that transaction will involve shifting as much equity as possible into the hands of management. And it works. It's just as commonplace as the minority deal. It's just driven by the aspirations of the founder and how involved they are in the business. So it works well. What we often find is that management team who have sort of a 10, 15, 20 year time horizon might have owned 30% of the business on day one, and the investor might have a majority, but they'll already have their eye on 2, 3, or 4 transactions that as the business grows, they're able to bring in new capital that slowly becomes a smaller and smaller percentage of the capital. So I don't think it's that dissimilar to what we discussed earlier. It's a model that works very well. And there's nothing worse, I think, than having passive founders owning most of the equity. It is the best possible tool to drive and incentivize growth in a people business. Why would you not want it in the hands of those driving the growth?
Yes, definitely. I will be sending this podcast to a couple of firms that I'm advising who are in this situation where, you know, very often one partner, one founder has stepped back, but very often with a big pile of shares.
Yeah.
And it's, in my view, it's about getting those out and to incentivize people as quickly as possible so that the value can be realized.
Yeah, it's also a fantastic outcome for the passive shareholder. Because if you think, if you went down a trade sale route, even a shareholder who's out of the business would be financially locked into an earnout for 2 or 3 years. But private equity buyouts do give you the ability to fully liquidate your shares on day one if you're no longer important to the business.
Yes. For that reason, PE is often a useful solution to quite complex shareholding as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and you've got absolutely.
People of different ages, different amounts, bought in at different times, and it can clear up a lot of the mess and allow growth. Brilliant. Yeah. Finally, Will, I wanted to talk about the future of M&A. Now, there's been a lot of change, as we've already discussed, over the last 10 years in terms of value proposition, in terms of the prevalence of merger and acquisition. How do you see that shifting, especially in this economic climate? How do you see things shifting over the next few years?
Yes, obviously, with your short-term hat on, the macroeconomy plays quite a lot into what we're likely to see. I think if we start with private equity, I think in the long term, all the fundamental principles that we've discussed are still there. So I don't think they're going anywhere in the medium to long term. I think what we are seeing from private equity in the short term is that there is an inherent nervousness around project-based businesses. What that does mean is if you can demonstrate some resilience through longer term contracts, or you've managed to pivot to selling product licenses or more managed service, that sort of resilience and longer term contractual underpin is still attracting some interest. Debt markets are challenged at the moment. Yeah. I think whenever private equity tend to want to use some level of debt in their transactions, so the more expensive debt gets, that will likely suppress valuations to some degree. But I think within those trends, what we are seeing is a flight to quality. So no one can escape the fact that private equity has more money to spend than they've ever had. They have to spend it somewhere. There are certain sectors wouldn't think of putting it at the moment.
And there are high growth pockets in the professional services market around cyber, ESG or data science that a lot of people still believe will grow through a downturn. So high quality businesses in the right markets will be okay, but we are likely to see a bit of impact over the next quarter. Strategics, I mean, if you look at what you just mentioned there, I mean, that strategics are going to continue to buy if they can fill in a capability gap they don't already have. They've always have done. There's no reason why they wouldn't do. So being very clear on what you can bring that is different to them is going to attract value. And again, as I mentioned, in the current talent markets, if you do have large bases of very technical, very skilled talent, they will see that as a route to quickly, basically acquiring large teams across. And that's often seen as easier and more effective to them than trying to hire. You've also got strategics backed by private equity. The thesis of the investment was to do a buy and build strategy. So it's in their plan that they will go and buy smaller consultancies and they'll consolidate the market. Given it's the plan, although they might pause for the next 3 months, that is going to be a medium-term trend that we see a lot of people doing that.
On that note about the future, obviously recurring revenue opportunities have increased for consulting firms, and it's strongly correlated to a higher multiple if you have a good portion of your revenue coming from recurring sources. And, you know, obviously with benchmarking, apps, software, maturity analyses, online courses, it's much cheaper to do this stuff than it was even 5 years ago. But I also know that private equity buyers often like simplicity. They like a clear category of project-based or SaaS or whatever. So is it something that you encourage, or you see it would be a good thing for consultancies to do, to explore the opportunities around benchmarking software, SaaS, etc.? Or is it something that you would see that might confuse buyers?
No, we would strongly encourage it. I think the thing we often see is that selling those sorts of products requires quite a different mindset to selling services. So a lot of our clients don't find it very easy to do. It's not really in their DNA. Lots of them are trying to do it, and lots of them have done it in quite a small way. So they'll have something on the side, as you say, that might be a marking tool or some sort of data product that they're able to sell on a subscription basis. But it normally will make up a very small portion of revenue and it won't become the core of the business. Those things are useful, and what those things really do, and they can often be quite strategic in that they're not necessarily the thing that's driving value in the business because it's so small, or it's not necessarily driving the bottom line. But what it does do is keep that particular client hooked. From having that hook and having them always engaging with you for this whatever very low cost solution is, you therefore always have them there to sell your advisory work or your implementation work or cross sell, whatever it is that still remains the core of the business. We love those sorts of things as that. When you say, do some private equity just love project-based businesses? Generally, the answer is no.
Sure.
They hate it. They put up with it because it's a high-value, high-margin, cash-generative business in a high-growth market. They would love to not have to have too much of the revenue coming from project-based. The way they get comfortable is, we often say it's reoccurring as opposed to recurring revenue. And when a client's been with you for the last 10 years and has done 4 or 5 different projects a year, you know from your customer calls with that client that the program that you're working on has another 10 years to run. It might not be signed on paper, but you have a fair amount of conviction that these projects are going to keep coming. That's how investors get comfortable with the project-based element of these businesses. I think the one thing they also like is when you have these tools and products, but they're actually, you don't necessarily sell them. It's just internalized. So it's internal IP that you're able to leverage and deliver an outcome here and then deliver an outcome over there for half the price because you've done it before and you've captured the sort of whatever it is, a plug and play solution or a data asset that you're able to leverage elsewhere. So trying to, and it's the same word again, but institutionalizing or capturing what you do so it's not stuck in the heads of smart consultants is very important. I think that's the key. And whether you're selling it as a product or you're using it internally, it can make you a bit different.
That's really good advice. And I would extend that to that it applies not just to what your consulting teams do, but also how you recruit, how you produce intellectual property, how you research the market and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, so much great value you've given us in a relatively short space of time. We've gone on longer than usual, but I think our listeners appreciate that. So thank you for your time.
You're very welcome, Joe. Thank you for that.
Take care.
Bye.
As ever, thank you for listening to the Consultancy Growth Podcast. This is Professor Joe Omani at joeomani.com.